Welcome to the Militant Grind Show, where we dive deep into the journeys of those who've mastered the art of being their best selves. Every episode is a testament to resilience, dedication, and the pursuit of excellence, embodying our tagline, the most honorables. Here you'll find inspiration, insights, and strategies to elevate your life in every aspect. For more empowering content and to join our community of achievers, visit us at militantgrind.com. Let's embark on this journey together because the grind never stops. Are you ready for a radical transformation? Join the ranks of the most honorables. Our proven methods forge resilience, sharpen strategic thinking, and unlock your true potential. We'll challenge you mentally, physically, and spiritually, preparing you to overcome any obstacle. Visit militantgrindacademy.com and begin your evolution. Greatness awaits. Forge your path. Ignite your future. Most of all, join the movement.
Meet Chad Hufford, a true Alaskan with a diverse background in finance, athletics, nutrition, and performance psychology. As Dave Ramsey's Smart Investor Pro and the leader of Veritas Wealth Management, Chad oversees $500 million and serves hundreds of families across the United States. Chad combines his financial expertise with a passion for fitness and faith, regularly speaking on these topics to promote purposeful and fulfilling lives. Chad, how are you doing today, sir?
I'm doing great. Sherman, thank you so much for having me. It's a pleasure to be here and to be able to hopefully add some confidence and clarity in your audience's finances, but also their future.
Man, thank you. I really appreciate you. And it's funny because I've just noticed that you have a vein popping out of your bicep right now, right? And so my background is financial services and taxes. And I was a guest on the podcast yesterday, and she was just like, I don't understand how a guy so fit and that looks like you is does taxes. Like, I would expect a nerdy, scrawny guy or this, is that, and the third. And so reading your bio, seeing that you combine faith and finances and fitness together, I was like, wow, this is kind of amazing. And it also is very rare. So how did you come about harnessing those three, but then also being so great at it?
Well, I don't know that I'm so great at it, but all three areas extremely important. And I was just having a conversation with a friend of mine who's a physician. He's a surgeon in Pennsylvania. Mm-hmm. And we were talking about, like, basically in life, sometimes you have to choose areas that you're going to be mediocre in, so you can pursue excellence in other areas. And those three areas you just mentioned, faith and fitness and finances, are three areas that I strive for excellence in. And it's non-negotiable. Like, I really go after those. And I was blessed to be raised in a family that valued all three of those areas. And it was more athletics than fitness. Like, we grew up in a family. My dad's from Iowa. So we grew up on Big Ten basketball, football, wrestling. Mm-hmm. So sports was just a natural part of that. And what I've experienced over the years is the discipline and the perseverance, the grit that is necessary to perform in sports. Yeah. are the same mindsets, the same characteristics that are necessary to build sustainable wealth and financial independence. So I was blessed to be in a family that had very healthy conversations around athletics and fitness, but also finances. And I just found a natural blending of those two things. And I would just say, Sherman, and this relates to you as well, I think our fitness is a physical manifestation of our discipline and our patience and our perseverance. But those things carry over to so many other areas. I just think they're foundational for living an abundant life.
Yeah, yeah. And I definitely understand that as well. But it's just kind of, I just get amazed how people don't feel like fitness is like an absolute necessity for their life. Because it's like, we're still human beings. We still need to be active. We still need to move around. And one thing that I've noticed, and I was just like, people say, oh, you have time to work out, time to go to the gym. But then I was like, it's only about an hour or 2 hours out of your day.
Yeah. And then they tell you how they don't have time. And then they're going to tell you about some new Netflix series that they just binge watched over 2 days. I'm like, okay.
Right. Right. And I love how you say, like, we have to pick and choose the things we're going to be great in and the things that we're going to be mediocre in. And I've actually been doing that in my life. I'm like, what can I cut out? Like, what am I what's not really serving me at this moment, and what do I need to focus in on? And I'm just like, I feel like it's a blessing to be able to focus in on things that could really bring strong values to your life. And like, I love to be entertained. I like comedy. I like to watch movies. But then I was just like, in order for me to be the person that I want to be, I have to cut some stuff out for sure.
Yeah. And I think that's a big part. Like a lot of people, when they look to become better, they look at what they can add. But sometimes we have to cut something out before we can add something in. Sometimes what you cut out actually has a bigger impact. It's just think about like somebody's diet. Like you can't out train a bad diet. So people look at what kind of exercises can I add? What can I do? What food should I add? Sometimes it's what you cut out. It's the foods that you eliminate. I think that's true in fitness. It's true in our life. It's true in finances. Like, I mean, just being able to live beneath your means, that is the number one rule. It doesn't matter how good your investments are. Doesn't matter how good your financial plan is. If you can't live below your means, if you can't spend less than you make, you're never going to build wealth. So a lot of times it's what do I need to cut out? So I think that carries over into so many facets of life. It's a very, very important concept. But in today's consumption society, where it's all about more, 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 we're going completely against the grain here.
Yeah. Yeah, definitely. I just actually had a consumption moment before this podcast. I saw some new headphones and I was like, wow, man, those look nice. Then I had to snap myself out of it and be like, what? You already have headphones. Like, why would you go ahead and buy some more just because they look nice or they look better? At the end of the day, the ones that you have is serving you. Like, you can hear is Bluetooth and that's all that you need. And I was just like, man, today in today's world, we're just bombarded with so many things to buy. Oh my yeah. God. It's like, it's all over the place. You get in the email, you get it on social media. And so how would you tell someone when it comes to like that type of discipline, like, you know what, figure out if you really need it. And if you do, okay. But then if you don't, don't deal with it at all. Cause I feel like financial discipline is extremely hard in today's society.
It is. And I think, so first of all, we're not hardwired to make decisions for our future. Mm. Like our genetics, the way the human being is designed, like our wet work is about surviving. And 2000 years ago, 5,000 years ago, whatever, we weren't worried about, where am I going to send my kids to college? Where am I going to retire? When am I going to sell my business? We're worried about, man, if I go to sleep behind this rock, is a lion going to eat me? Is a saber-toothed tiger? Like, we weren't worried about this long-term. So we were designed to very much focus on temporary comfort over long-term security. And we have to reverse that. And we live in a culture that, as you said, it very much feeds, hey, man, just be comfortable today. Do what makes you happy. Do what makes you comfortable, which is usually at the cost of our future selves. Mm-hmm. So we've got to be able to flip that and serve our future selves rather than stealing from that person. And I think when it comes to consumption, so I say that background because I think we are naturally consumption oriented. However, as you mentioned, we are in this period of time where we are bombarded by it. It is like you open up your email in the sidebar, it's like all these things those ads aren't just ads. They're ads specifically geared to what your computer knows you are going to be interested in. They know it's going to pique your interest. So I think our world, our society with social media and advertising and everything is designed to get us to focus on what we don't have rather than the blessings that are already in our life. So what I do is I start every single day with a gratitude list. And sometimes it's super simple. Sometimes it's really profound. Sometimes it's really, really basic. Like, man, I'm just like one of the things that I put on there this morning was just grateful for the time I've been able to spend with my wife in the evenings this week. We had a really busy week. We didn't get to see each other during the day at all. And we went to Costco together. Like that was not a big deal, but I was just thankful for that. It's those little things. Like there's a million things out there that would be cool to have. But when we focus on what's already in our life, it's easier to ignore what we don't have. So yeah. I think that's a great starting place for people. And here's another thing to think about too, is if this is crazy, but if you don't have the money to buy it, then you can't afford it. Mm-hmm. Like we don't do loans. We don't do payment plans. If you can't pay cash, you can't afford it. Doesn't matter how good the deal is, it's not a good deal for you if it doesn't fit in your budget. And like, that's really simple. It's basic, like it's common sense, but nobody's doing that right now.
Right.
Sherman, people buy things with money they don't have. They buy things they don't need with money they don't have to impress people that they don't even really like. Like, that's the craziness of the consumption culture that you and I live in.
Yeah, and I see it all the time. And me doing taxes for over a decade, like, I know what people really make. Like, I've been in the mortgage industry since 2005. So I've seen all kind of W-2s and things like that. And I started to realize that people really don't have money like I thought they did. It's like a lot of people are in debt. A lot of people can't even afford to really put a down payment on a house. And it's like people will get these things on credit, and it's just like really harming them in order to pay. And I'll tell people this too. I'm like, if someone gets approved for a house for, I'm in LA, so let's say 900,000, 800,000, how much is the home they're gonna look for gonna be worth? That price between 800 and 900. They're not gonna say, oh, I got approved for 900,000, I'm gonna find a home for 700.
Right.
No, that's never really the case. But it's like they will push you to your debt to income ratio because it makes sense. It's like the better, the more expensive it is, the better the house. But then it's like when it comes to paying those bills, and let's say, the pipes bursted, or, oh, this happened to the washer and dryer, this is that and the third. When it comes to owning a home, most people will go deeper into debt just to maintain it. And I'm just like, wow, this cycle is like insane, you know?
Well, and here's what you're talking about. And it goes back to something you mentioned earlier. People have no margin in their life. And that goes in their finances. They've got maxed out mortgages, maxed out credit cards, but we've also got maxed out schedules, maxed out waistlines. Like, we have no margin. We consume more food than we're burning, and it creates obesity, it causes metabolic syndrome, creates all kinds of other issues, diabetes. We max out our schedules. We fill it with doom scrolling on social media, with Netflix, with TV, with just mindless stuff. Like, we max out every area of our life. So when life happens, and it will, doesn't matter how careful your life, like, you, life will happen. Life will throw you a curveball, and you've got to have margin. You got to have margin in your budget. You got to have margin in your cash flow. You got to have margin in your schedule. And one of the things for me that it was hard to do is just have margin, like, at the end of the day, to just find stillness. Cause I feel like I got to fill it. I got to be listening to a podcast, got to be listening to a book, got to be studying, got to be doing this, got to be that. Like, no, I have margin. I've got to be able to just sit back and, like, listen to my soul a little bit at the end of the day. And what we have in our culture right now is people fill up every area of their life. And like you said, the pipes burst. You have no margin, and now the dominoes start falling really, really quickly.
Yeah, and that's one thing I discovered. I grew up with a father that was very frugal, and now I'm like, oh my God, now that I'm a father with children and a husband, I'm like, oh, whoa, I could see why. And I had to, like, I had to cut out so many things. Like, I scanned my bank account last month, and I was like, I'm not using this, I'm not using that. And I'm just like, why am I getting all of these recurring charges? But it's like, it feels good to be able to say, I could use this tool. But it's like, if you're not really effectively using it, you need to cut it out. Like, if you're not, like, using it weekly, daily, or something, just stop paying for it. But I was just, like, so adamant on just having access. Like, I have access to it, though. If I need it, I can use it. But then I was like, man, come on. Like, just be real with yourself.
Yeah,
just a hell of a lot of discipline.
Well, it's just like that mortgage, right? Just because a $900,000 mortgage is available, it doesn't mean that's what's fitting in your life. And it does. Right. It takes a lot of discipline. We keep coming back to that. We talk about discipline all day, but that's really what it comes down to, is the discipline to say no to the distractions. And we live in a very distracted world. And I think a lot of people wait until those distractions subside, until they make better decisions. And they never will. Those distractions will always be there. You had a guest on your show here recently that lost like over 100 pounds. I can't remember what it was, like 120 pounds or something crazy like that. And I can't remember his name. Anyways,
okay.
You guys were talking about his weight loss journey, And one of the things he said is how we have normalized unhealthy eating habits. We've normalized being obese. We've normalized, and I think we've, beyond just physical health, we've normalized poor physical health. We've normalized poor financial health. We've normalized poor mental health, and we've just made it normal to be this way. So like for you and I, trying to raise kids in this culture is difficult, trying to get kids to see everything around them and say, you got to do it different.
Oh, wait. Oh my God. Me and my wife just had a conversation about that. And I was just like, man, that is going to be a hell of a challenge because what they see is not really like the reality of how the world really is. And we're having like a challenge with talking about sexuality and faith and all kind of stuff that we necessarily didn't get bombarded with. It was like normal for us to go to church every Sunday in my community. Like, and a lot of the things that are normal now, it's just like, nah, it wasn't normal when I was a kid. Like, it's kind of crazy where it's normal for kids to take pharmaceuticals and just for their mind, like kids being diagnosed with ADD, ADHD, and all of these different things. And I'm just like, oh my God, what? And I have to have a strong defense, possibly move to Alaska or something like that, because it's
Hey,
what,
man,
man.
we got it up here too. I don't know that it would be a lot better, but it's all around us. And even if it's not in your community, it's still all over online. And again, like it's like a fish swimming upstream. Sorry, we're in Alaska. Going to use fish analogies, but salmon swim upstream to spawn. So if you didn't know that, now, but that's what it is. Like everything, it feels like is going the opposite direction, and we're trying to push through it. And yeah, raising kids in that is hard. How many kids do you have?
Four.
You have four. Okay. What are the ages?
One's about to be 11 in a couple of days. 11, 7, 5, and 2.
Okay. You're in the thick of it. All
Oh,
right.
yeah. Yeah. Definitely. Definitely. You have how many?
We have six.
Oh, God.
We have six.
What's that?
My baby girl turns 12 today. She's our youngest daughter. And we've got a girl that's almost 16. And then my sons are 14, 10, 6, and 4.
Oh, wow. Oh, yeah. So that's almost like all within a, what, how many years? 8 years?
We had four real quick. So the oldest four, we had within about 5 years, then we had a little gap, and then we had 2 in 2 years. So I'm just trying to think, what is the age gap? So the age gap is like 10, 11 years between the oldest and youngest, but it was almost like two little blocks.
Yeah.
But yeah. It's raising them in this world and trying to, like you said, I mean, get them to see what is true rather than what is popular. And one of the things too, that drives me nuts talking about money is like, because of social media, like people can fake it. You have a lot of broke people out there explaining how to be financially secure. You have a lot of broke people teaching about wealth, and I'm like, my goodness, this is garbage.
Yeah, man. I mean, honestly, I got to a point. I'm not. Are you Christian?
Yes, sir.
Okay, so I had a ecclesiastical moment. That's what I'll call it 3 weeks ago, and I was just like, all of this is pointless. What is this? What is that? And I just got so frustrated, and I just deleted all of my social media accounts because I just got so tired of seeing people that I personally know that don't have it like that, that try to flaunt like they're super successful. And it just bothered me to my core. And I was like, if I'm looking at this, I'm going to end up training my mind to do the same thing. Just like me being an alpha dominant male, it's kind of like I want to dominate. But then I'm like, I can't dominate in the fugazi kind of space. Like, people are just teaching people how to be wealthy so they could get wealthy, but they necessarily haven't achieved wealth themselves.
And here's what's crazy about it too, is we don't see wealth.
Mm-hmm.
Wealth is the investments, the bank accounts, the real estate portfolio behind closed doors. You don't see wealth. What you see is spending.
Mm-hmm.
The Louis Vuitton bag, the fancy shoes, the fancy car, the exotic vacation. That's not wealth. That's consumption.
Mm-hmm.
So our culture has seen consumption. We've confused it with wealth. Like, that dude's driving a Ferrari, he must be wealthy. No, that dude's driving a Ferrari, he might be flat broke. Like, yeah. We don't know if he's wealthy or not. All we know is that he's got $250,000 less than he did before he bought that Ferrari.
Yeah.
That's all we know.
Yeah.
And there are people that make really good cash flow, that have good incomes, that are terrible financial managers, and they're living paycheck to paycheck.
Yeah.
I met with somebody the other day, living paycheck to paycheck, making 400 grand a year. We see it with professional athletes. I mean, Allen Iverson went bankrupt recently. For your younger audience, he was a basketball player that played when I was growing up. Short dude, guy was amazing, so fun to watch. But no, he made almost $200 million in his career and filed for bankruptcy. Antonio Brown on the football side of things, just so we don't alienate your football fans. He just filed for bankruptcy, my son said, in the last couple of weeks. He made well over $100 million in his career. So my point to this is what we see and have come to worship isn't actually true financial independence. It's not abundance. It's consumption. And a lot of that is actually fueled by a scarcity mindset. Those people that spend all that money, that buy the stuff, that are trying to fake it till they make it, or maybe have made it to some degree, they're not really enjoying their wealth. They're using money as a way to overcome their own insecurities. I guarantee you they're not enjoying it the way it should. Money is controlling them rather than them controlling their finances. And one thing I always tell people is money is a great servant, but it's a terrible master.
I could definitely see that. And I've been a victim of that as well. Like sometimes I think back and I'm like, why did you buy that car, man? You didn't have to do that. You could have almost bought a car cash with the down payment that you put down on that vehicle. It could have been okay with no payment. And yeah, trust me, I've been there. I see it. And then it's crazy because I have a mentor, right, that's in the market to buy a Major League Baseball team. And I will meet up with him and he'll pull up in a Honda Accord. And I'm just like, no one would ever guess that he is really like searching to purchase a Major League Baseball team based on what he drives. And then I'll have one friend pull up in a brand new S-Class Benz that is like in financial trouble. And I was just like, wow, like this is really crazy. Like when I step back and really like observe and look at how like all of the people that I know that have these liabilities, how they're really living, like they're stressing trying to take care of these liabilities. And it is just like, that's not even really freedom. It's like, it's crazy. Like you said, that goes back to you saying money is your master. You know, so I say there'll be somebody online that'll try to sell me a product or a service and they'll say, okay, I made $400,000 in a month, or I make this amount in a month for $200,000. I'm like, okay, well, show me your bank statements. No, that's the only way I'm going to believe. One guy, he showed me his QuickBooks, but I was like, come on, bro, I'm smarter than that. Like, you can put anything in QuickBooks. But bank statements, certified bank statements, that's the only way I could really believe you. Other than that, it's like all fluff.
And even if you are making it, I mean, so I believe there's a difference between being rich and being wealthy. So wealth is about assets. It's about having assets that can generate income and can sustain you. You can be rich and have a lot of income, but have no assets to show for it. So maybe the guy's telling it, maybe the guy's making seven figures. But if you don't have real assets, you don't have true wealth, and if you're not controlling it, income can be easy come, easy go. And to your point about your mentor, like he doesn't need to fake it. He doesn't need to buy stuff because he has real assets.
Right.
And that's what I love about the people we work with. We've got our typical client, Sherman, is a blue collar millionaire. They don't have incredible jobs. They have difficult jobs, pay good money, but it wasn't so much about how much they made. It's about what they did with the money that they brought in. They were intentional. They were disciplined with it. They were patient. They have perseverance. And we have guys and gals that come in that are worth the multimillionaires. And the girls are wearing stuff that they bought from the secondhand, like from Value Village. And the dudes are wearing like Carhartt pants with patches on the knee. And they just don't care. They don't need to prove anything to anybody, because they're secure with who they are and what they've been able to accomplish. And they know that they're never going to need a paycheck ever again, because they've learned how to live within their means. And their investments, their wealth is able to protect and sustain their lifestyle indefinitely. And they have what rich people don't. And that is a sense of enough.
That's kind of, I had a conversation with someone about like simple people, and the people that are super simple always make the best financial decisions. And I was like, man, I met a guy because I'm from the big city, LA, and I was talking to some people, my family members from Chicago. And I was like, man, I know some guys from like Alabama and Oklahoma that are very wealthy and successful, but I feel like they come from an environment where it's like flossing and fancy cars. Like in LA, I mean, if I go outside my house right now, I'm probably gonna see a brand new Tesla, BMW, might see a Bentley or a Lambo truck or something of that nature, right? But I'm like, these guys are in areas that are impoverished, so they don't really care about stuff like that. They're like, okay, I'm gonna figure out a way to generate wealth, and I'm gonna just live within my means, because I feel like they probably haven't even seeing things that makes them say, okay, I want that. I want to spend all of that money. Because for me in LA, that's like going up a uphill battle. Because I say my oldest daughter lives in Arizona, and she was like, Daddy, have you ever seen a Tesla Cybertruck? And I'm like, yeah, I see them all the time. But man, since she's been here, she's never seen one. But since she's been here, she's seen like six of them. At first, she was like, oh my God, there goes the sign. Now she's like, oh, there goes the Cybertruck. So it's like, I was thinking about, I was like, man, if she lived out here, she would end up being ambitious to figure out ways where she could accumulate these type of liabilities just because it's the thing in this environment.
No, I think environment is huge. And that's whether you're trying to get in better shape, build a better marriage, build a better business, or build better fight. Your environment is huge. And it's not, we don't necessarily need to get up and move, but we might need to reorchestrate our environment and even who we hang out with, because there's different places. I mean, Alaska, I think, is, we have a mixed culture, a lot of different things. I mean, there's up here, it's not, Bentleys and Beamers and stuff like that. It's like airplanes, and boats and ATVs and things like that. Like, that's what gets people going up here, where they get buried in debt with their toys. So it's just different. Like, I think different places have maybe different temptations, but it's one of the things that is really important for building sustainable wealth is really knowing what's important to you. Because we've both mentioned it in different ways, but what we've said is, there's so many people out there that are buying things for other people. They're buying things because of what they think is important to somebody else or impress somebody else. But some of the other folks you've mentioned have, you said, very simple lives. Those people know what's important to them, and they control their money. Their money is directed towards what is vitally important to them, not what they think is going to impress their neighbor or their boss or the dude that they don't even like from high school anymore. And it's hard. It's almost impossible to build a financial security, financial freedom, while you're buying things to impress the people around you. Again, it goes back to what we said a few minutes ago about going against the grain. Like, we just have to be willing to live different, to be abnormal in a culture that is pulling everybody in the wrong direction.
Right. And so, speaking of that, you do have your own wealth management firm, right? So how did you end up getting into that? Like, did you help yourself first and then decided, okay, I want to help other people get wealthy?
So my degree is in biochemistry. I was going into medicine, and I met the woman who is now my wife and the mother of my six kids in my senior year, and realized pretty quickly, because she had a very unstable background. Like, she didn't want a surgeon. She wanted a husband, and she wanted a family. And I had a background. My dad was in the financial industry. He taught classes in our church. Before Dave Ramsey, there was a guy named Larry Burkett. I don't know if you're familiar with Larry Burkett, but they had more of a Bible study than a financial class, but it was about stewardship, and it was about finances, and about how to make good decisions with your money. And now I was raised in that. And for me, that was normal. I didn't realize how abnormal my childhood was until I got to college, because we were homeschooled and a little sheltered. We got to college, and everybody's in debt and credit cards, and you got kids with no jobs driving brand new vehicles. Like, this is nuts. Like, how does this happen? I realized everybody's in debt. And so, not to be too long-winded, but Sherman, what I realized was the blessing that I'd been given. Like, I saw what worked. I mean, we already talked, you talked about Ecclesiastes. Like, I just think of the financial principles in Ecclesiastes and Proverbs. I was taught that as a very young age. It was just normal. So by the time I was in my mid-20s, Sherman, I'd realized like I've been given a gift. And I felt obligated and I felt a duty to share that with the world because I'd seen it work. I've seen lives change. And here's the cool thing about finances, because finances infiltrate every area of our life. And some people are like, well, investing is intimidating or budgets are hard, or like I choose to ignore it. It's not going to work. Like, finances are like health. If you ignore it will only deteriorate. Like, if you ignore your physical fitness, it will only get worse. If you ignore your finances, it will only deteriorate. And I saw that being the attitude so many people had, but I also realized what I had been given and the way that it changed people's trajectory. Because when somebody can feel confidence and clarity in their finances, when they see a path ahead of them, they realize that they can affect their future. They have agency. That doesn't just stay in their finances. They start making better, more intentional, more disciplined decisions in every area of their life. So I had seen financial coaching and financial advising, financial planning change life trajectories. And it was just something I was excited to be a part of. And that was 17 years ago that I opened my practice. And it's been an amazing experience ever since, because we just our why, like the reason we exist, Sherman, is not to help people make a ton of money. It's to help them live a more abundant life. And we just use finances and investing as our tool to do that.
Well, that's amazing. I mean, biochemistry is definitely a far cry from finance. But I do know that you're a very smart person. That's one thing I will say. Because I was a business finance major and I took a biology class, and oh my God, it was so difficult for me. I was like, golly, just because I didn't care about that stuff. Like, it's hard for me to learn something that I just absolutely don't care about. And I was like, why am I learning this? Like, I'm a finance major, but it was just like one of the prerequisites. So yeah, I will say that. Like, if you could make it through that, you could probably make it in anything.
Well, I'll tell you what. So it taught me discipline. It taught me perseverance. I chose it because I mean, obviously it led into medicine, but also it was the hardest degree that we had. And a lot of people going to medicine will do like biology or something like that as undergrad, at least at that time. I don't know what they're doing now, but I wanted something that would stand out. But it also kept me out of trouble. Like, my friends would be out partying and doing stuff, and I was studying for a test. My 21st birthday, I spent studying for the physical chemistry test. That's how I spent it, in my dorm room or in my room by myself. So I think it imparted into me this idea that I didn't have to do what everybody else was doing. I was gonna go a different path. And as we've already talked about, like, that's so necessary to make that choice, that if I want my life to have different results than everybody else is getting, I've got to make decisions and behavioral changes that are different than everybody else is making. And so I think I came to terms with that very, very early. And the part of it that actually is really interesting is the problem-solving aspect of biochemistry. We have all these different variables. You're trying to figure out how to get them to all fit into this puzzle. Financial planning is very much the same way. So it was really a blessing, even though I wouldn't necessarily recommend this being the path everybody takes if they're wanting to go into wealth management. But for me, it was perfect, and I could just see God's hand shaping me, molding me, and directing me through that process.
And how do you source your clients? Like, are most of them from Alaska or like local to your area? Because I'm trying to figure out how you basically got up to like a 500 million wealth management. Like, that is an astronomical number. You have to really know some people to get up there.
Well, and we're super picky about who we work with too. Like, if you were to sit down with the folks we work with, you'd be like, oh my goodness, these are fantastic human beings. These are fantastic human beings. So we screen more for temperament and mindset than we do for income. A lot of people have like income limits and things like, you got to make at least this much money, you got to have at least this much money to invest. But it's more about who you are, like your mentality. That matters more. You're it's not I mean, education helps, having a great career helps, all those different things. But what separates successful investors from everybody else is more mindset and temperament than anything. So that's what we kind of screen for. But to answer your question, a lot of our folks, we have folks all over the US, but a lot of them have some sort of Alaska connection. Either they used to live in Alaska or they were referred by somebody in Alaska. We have some folks that live in like the South that work up here. They work on the oil field. So it's like two or three weeks on, 2 or 3 weeks off, but they live in like Louisiana or Florida or North Carolina, and they just commute back. So there's usually some sort of Alaska connection, but not necessarily. I mean, that's the beauty of today's world is we can work with pretty much anyone from anywhere, and we can work from anywhere. I could be in Arizona working, I'd be up here working, I could be in LA working. And it's really awesome to be able to leverage technology, to be able to connect like this, have conversations, even to what we're doing right now, having a one-to-many conversation. So it gives us the opportunity to have an impact in people's lives, regardless of where they live.
Right. Yeah. That is amazing. Cause I often think about this. I'm like, man, 15 years ago, if you were to tell me that I would be talking to somebody through an online camera and it looks clear and we're able to put it on you, I'm like, well, you must be crazy. Like, there's no way that could happen, but technology allows us to connect with people from all over. And I feel like that's also an amazing thing, especially if you're running a business.
Yeah. And think of like, think about your business, like both of us, we work with people on a very intimate level with their finances. I mean, people share things with us professionally that they wouldn't even share with their best friends or their family members.
Right.
So it's very relationship driven. Like you have to have good relationship capital. But my CPA, he lives in Texas. And because of technology, we're able to keep really good communication and able to keep that relationship strong. And it's beautiful. What we try to be careful of is not over leveraging technology, where technology becomes a crutch, but we want to make sure that we're utilizing that to keep in touch with people and to keep those relationships strong and make sure that we're having the influence and impact that we need to.
Yeah, definitely. Because I still feel like the human connection, like face-to-face, is still necessary for you to like feel someone's energy, read who they are and stuff like that. So do you have people like fly in to meet you in person and you give a presentation and stuff like that?
We do. And a lot of the folks that we work with, I've met with face-to-face at some point, but not everybody. I mean, I have folks that I have never met face-to-face. But I absolutely agree with you. There's nothing that replaces face-to-face. But for our folks who are out of state, whether I go down to meet with them periodically or they come up here, if you have long gaps in between that face-to-face, things like Zoom and Teams and FaceTime and all that, it really helps bridge that gap. It allows you to feel connected in between those stretches where you're maybe not able to meet face-to-face. But I'm with you. Face-to-face is still my favorite.
Yeah.
Same. It's just hard being in Alaska. We realize like that's if we're going to grow and scale this thing, we can't have every single meeting face to face. Even in Alaska, even for our Alaska clients, we have clients that are still 500 miles away, even though they live in the state. Because it's such a diverse, spread out state. And in fact, a little bit of trivia. So Alaska actually has less than one person per square mile.
Really? Oh, so how many people are in the state itself?
Like 700,000.
Oh, that's it?
700,000. And we're 750,000 square miles in the state.
Oh, but so, most of that is wildlife though, right?
No, it's most of it is complete wilderness. Yeah.
Yeah.
That's what I'm saying though, is like people are so spread out here that we have 700,000 people, which is that's a neighborhood in LA, right? Yeah. And we're spread across a landmass that is it would be twice the size of Texas. In fact, I think you could fit Texas, two Texases and half of California inside Alaska, and we have 700,000 people. So Alaska's population is very, very spread out, which again, that means that we've got to be able to connect a lot of different ways. I see some of my out-of-state people more often than I see some of my Alaska people because they live in such remote areas.
Right. Wow.
It's wild. Yeah.
I mean, if you move to Texas, you'll really be boom. But I understand though, but golly, I couldn't imagine that life. So I also heard that they're incentivizing people to move out there, like paying them a salary or something like that. just to live in Alaska?
It's not quite like that, and it's not really an incentive to move. So there's obviously a lot of oil in Alaska. That's a huge part of infrastructure. Oil pays for most everything up here, oil and tourism, or at least natural resources and tourism, but oil is a big part of that. So years and years ago, what they did is they instituted it's almost like a trust fund. So as part of the kind of permission to play up here, oil companies paid into that, and that money was invested, and then Alaskans get a dividend from that every year as long as they remain Alaska residents.
Oh,
So,
okay.
I mean, it's not insignificant. I think last year was about $1,000 a person, but it's also a high cost of living and things like that. So if you're moving to Alaska for your $1,000, unless you're coming from like LA or New York or a place that is really, really expensive, that money's gonna disappear real quick because everything up here costs more because you're shipping it so far. But I mean, we love living here, Sherman. We love being here, and they're gonna give us a few extra bucks to stay here. That it pays for some flights out so we can warm up in the wintertime.
And I heard it's beautiful, like the landscape and everything is gorgeous. So I can understand. But like you said, it's like what's important to you. And if you grew up out there, you're used to it. It's like, okay, this is my thing. Because me growing up in LA, when people say, okay, move to the South or move to a rural area, it sounds good. But then when I go visit my wife's grandparents in Atlanta, they live in the outskirts. And I'm just like, oh my God, I have no idea how they do this. It's like I'm driving on the road. I almost hit a deer at night one time. It scared me to death. Like there's only a one place you could shop. I'm like, oh my God, this is horrible. But growing up in LA with all of these different cultures, I'm like, I could eat Japanese food, I could eat Chinese, I could eat Jamaican, I could do this, I could do that. And I'm just so used to like so much variety that it's kind of hard for my mind to shake that. But I could understand why, like, if someone like you were to move to LA with your family, you'll probably be like, oh no, this is way too much.
It's, yeah, I get like the traffic for me, that gets old really fast. There's certain aspects of a big city that I like. My little brother lives in Phoenix. We were just down there a couple months ago, and I enjoy it. But after about a week, I'm like, yeah, I've had enough. And what we have, so Anchorage is about 300,000 people. So we've got the malls and the shopping centers and the restaurants, and because we have there's a lot of Asian influence, so we have a lot of very cool ethnic restaurants, like mom and pop type family-owned restaurants. So you get some variety there, but then we live actually up on the side of a mountain about 15 minutes outside. So like we can get everything we need in the city, but then I just on the way in this morning, drove past like an 800-pound moose. So I mean,
Oh, wow. Really?
We had a bear in our yard a couple of weeks ago. Like, it's pretty cool. We have a really nice balance between having access to pretty much anything that we want, other than sports. That's the thing that I would miss, that I do miss, is having like sports teams. We were just talking about this as a family. Like we were down in Phoenix and watched some games, and it would be cool to have a team right here, but the population is just too small to support that.
Yeah, so you just have high school football games and basketball
Yep.
games that you could go to.
And then and we plan travel around that. So like when we went to Arizona, we planned it around we went to the national championship, the ba national UConn and Purdue, the basketball game. So yeah, we just fly out, we see those things, and it kind of gives us an excuse to go to different cool places, and we'll see a game. But it would be cool to have our own hometown team.
The other teams will complain like, oh God, we got to play Anchorage. Oh
Yeah.
yeah. But I'm sure it'll like boost the economy like no other out there though. Oh my God. Because it's like if there's no, I figured that the towns that really don't have like much to do when they have like a big university or something like that, like people go to the games, it's packed. Everybody is like diehard fans, like the Florida Gators. I watched a documentary about them, and they're like in the middle of nowhere. But it's like the support they get is astronomical. Like people are
Yes.
crazy about them. But in LA, it's like we're not crazy about UCLA or USC. It's like, We'll go to the, but it's not like, hey man, did you catch the USC game? I'm like, what? No, I went to the Rams. I went to the Chargers. So yeah, I could get that. Oh, and also I want to ask you, so what are the benefits that you see from like you being homeschooled and your children being homeschooled?
Well, we touched on it a little bit already, because it's that idea that being able to do things differently, and we're going against the grain of culture. Like, we're not trying to keep them sheltered to the point where they don't know what's going on around them, but we don't want them to be inundated with it. So by being homeschooled, we're able to be more intentional about what they're learning and who they're around, who their circle is. And again, they do, like, they have this youth week this week at a Christian school here. So they're with a bunch of kids. They're doing all these different things, but we have a little bit more purposefulness around who their circle of friends are, what they're doing. So homeschooling now is very different than when I grew up 40 years ago. And I mean, back then it was like pioneers. We're making up as we went. And I mean, we hit all the stereotypes. My mom made her own clothes. Like, it was ridiculous. I was a total dork. Yeah. I'm sure my parents probably had to pay people to hang out with me to be my friend. I don't know. But I mean, it was a little extreme. But now, my kids, like, they're learning skill sets. My daughter, my oldest daughter, she's 15, almost 16. She works 3 days here at the office. So she brings her school in, she'll do some of that. So it just gives us a lot of flexibility. It also allows us to push our kids in the areas that they need to be pushed, but to give them more time in the areas that they might struggle with. So right. we do have kids that are maybe a couple grades apart in different subjects. Like, maybe they're doing like fourth grade English and sixth grade math or something like that. But I think the biggest thing is kind of like what we talked about earlier about, like, what do you choose to eliminate? We're trying to reduce or mitigate a lot of the negative influences that are a part of the public school system wherever you go. Not completely limit. We want them to be exposed to that to some degree, but just not to be inundated with it all day, every day.
Wow, that's amazing. Because honestly, like, I'm listening to this, and if I was to like talk, I always do like social tests or whatever, and I'm gonna send a text message and be like, man, I just talked to this guy that runs a wealth management company where he manages $500 million, and he homeschools six children. And I guarantee you, my friends are going to be like, how in the hell does he do that? You know, like, it's like, because people will be like, how do you do it? How do you find the time? How do you work with each child? Because it's a lot. But it's like, you're doing something that I guarantee you the majority of people will be like, it's almost impossible to make that happen. So I just want to give kudos to you for actually doing it. And because I hear a lot of theory and what people will think is best for their child. Sometimes I do hear homeschool. And we all know that if you're in control of your children's education, that should bring about the best result. Like homeschool sounds amazing to probably the majority of the people, but it's like a lot of them aren't capable to actually do it. But I thought, like, hearing a parent say, this is what I feel like is best for my child, I'm going to guard them from all of the social pressures, which is something that I talk to with parents where it's like so intense, where they're like, man, I have to move out the country or something. Like, it's crazy, especially when it comes to spiritual beliefs, faith, yes, sexuality, and all of these different things just being put on our children. And hearing someone say, okay, I'm going to take the step to homeschool them, it's like very amazing. Because trust me, as a parent, I hear about all kind of stuff, like with other parents at my children's school, where it comes to like our children's best interests. So,
well, we've talked so much about being different, living different. It's really, really hard to get kids to think differently and act differently when we're dumping them into the system with everybody else. Yeah. Not impossible. It's just a lot harder. But I also realize it's a blessing to be able to homeschool. Like, my wife is able to stay home with the kids. And that was really, really hard early on, trying to get the business going on only one income. And I mean, it was rough. I'm not going to pretend this has been an easy ride, but God has blessed us to where my wife can stay home, and that really helps, makes a huge difference, but it's not for everybody. I mean, not everybody has the means, the ability to homeschool. But I think the intentionality in your kids' education, whether they are homeschooled, whether they're private school, or they're public school, that's the biggest thing. And we just had a meeting with our church the other day, and there's a private school attached to that. And one of the pastors was saying one of their big struggles is parents who figure like, okay, I'm bringing my kid to private school, so I don't need to be involved in their education anymore. They abdicate their role as a parent. Mm-hmm. And it produces really, really poor results. So I don't care where your kid goes to school. Be a part of their life and be a part of their education. Do not abdicate your role as their mother, their father. It is not your school's job to raise your child. Mm-hmm. It is to teach them specific skill sets, but their character and their values, that has to come from the parent. So I think that people can get really good results in any situation. But it's just, it's going to be harder in a public school situation.
Yeah. Yeah, definitely. Definitely. And I see that too, because I live in a high net worth area, but also know that like some kids have behavioral issues. It doesn't matter. But then it's like, I just feel like, well, versus me growing up in the inner city and my children growing up here where I'm at and in the outskirts, it's just like, I'm just glad that they're able to see two parent households, families, dads, things of that sort. So I'm like, that's going to bring about a better result than the situation that I grew up in, where it was like, I grew up with both of my parents in the home. But for me being a Black man in LA, it was an automatic assumption that my father was not in the home. Like, they wouldn't even dare mention that. I'll be like, hold on, I'm more scared of my dad than my mom. Like, what's going on? But now it kind of like reversed, where it's like, okay, my daughter can't understand how somebody could have a child and not be married. And I was just like, wow, that's amazing how different an environment could basically just like, when you put your children in different environments, it teaches them different things. Yes. Like, I walk my children to school with other dads. Dads are the ones that take their kids to school. That's me awesome. Growing up, I don't even know what my friends' dads look like. Wow. It was like especially their real dad. It might be a stepdad or mom's, but I was just like, wow, this is different, but it's amazing.
No, that's super special. That's awesome that you do that. I love that. That's my favorite part of our conversation so far. Just thinking about you walking your kids to school, because I mean, there's so many problems in our country, and it's hard to even know where to start. But I think dads have to step into that role. Dads have to lead, not just to give orders and dictate, but to lead and lead with vulnerability and with courage. And that means, it means showing your scars and your battle wounds to your kids, to your wife. And it's going to be hard. It's going to be painful. But that's what we need is fathers who aren't just leading their kids to school physically, but metaphorically doing that as well. That's super cool, man. I appreciate you sharing that.
I didn't even think it was a big deal, but now
I think it's a huge deal. Yeah. I think it is a huge deal.
Man, I appreciate that, man, because like, no matter how I'm feeling, I'll wake up and walk them to school when I'm dead tired or whatever. And before they go in the gate, I tell them affirmation, you're a genius, you're smart, you're good today. Kiss them on the head, kiss my son on the head, my daughter, okay, go in school. And I was just thinking about like, man, how much, even though it's like such a small act, it could go such a long way. Because I know that I didn't have a father to tell me that. So I'm like, what if I did? Okay, well, I can't, it already passed. So I just have to do that with my children.
You know what, though? So your kids may not appreciate it right now, but they will. They will in the future. Because you've been doing it. It's normal to them. But at some point, it might be in their teens, might be in their 20s, it might be when they're 50. But they're going to look back like, man, my dad walked me to school every day. And that was awesome. Mm-hmm. And like, for me, it was like my dad being at sports games and things like that. And sometimes they didn't even want him there. Because I'm like, man, I can't yell at the ref. I can't goof around with my teammates. Like, I've got to play it cool because my dad is watching and I don't want to earn his wrath afterwards.
Right, but, right.
But it was like, I didn't really realize how pivotal that was. And my dad almost never missed a game. He hardly missed a practice. And for you walking your kids to school every day, like that's going to be transformational. And your kids are going to look back and be like, they're going to realize that is a thread woven through their childhood that will serve them for the rest of their life. So keep doing
Yeah.
it, brother. That's
Thank
awesome.
you, man. I appreciate that. And I will tell you to really appreciate your dad, because I know people whose parent whose fathers never showed up for a game, never showed up for a practice. People that are close to me that tell me how much it hurt them that their parent that their father never showed up. So yeah, trust me, it hurt. Even like till this day, I'm just like, are you a fan of rap at all?
Yes.
Okay, so Jay-Z is one of my favorite rappers, right? He ended up becoming one of the best rappers in the world. But often in his songs, he'll talk about how his uncle told him that he'll never be like LL Cool J when he was like practicing rapping as a young child. And I was talking to one of my friends about that. I was just like, it's crazy how he's one of the most successful rappers of all time. But he mentions that part of his life as if it happened yesterday, and it obviously is still affecting him.
Yeah.
And I'm just like, I can name the song. I can name it's a So Ambitious on Blueprint 3. If you listen to it, he'll talk about it vividly. Like, my uncle said I'll never be like LL Cool J and this, and he'll mention it through other many songs. I'm just like, wow, we really have to be careful what we tell people, because it can affect them in like such ways where it's like we think that they should get over it. Oh, it happened. Oh, it's old. Oh, look at you now. But it still impacts them.
The wounds are still there. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So
And
instead of like looking at how it can impact them, the wound can impact them. I'm like, okay, now let's think about how pouring life in somebody could impact them as well. So yeah, man, thank you for that. I really appreciate that. And I'm sure you have a big time client you got to talk to in about 10 minutes. But I want to thank you for being a part of this podcast, man. It's been a great conversation. I cannot wait to share this with my friends and family. Very insightful. And it's a pleasure to talk to a man of your stature that has a family, that has a business, and that has six kids. You are very rare in today's time. So thank you.
It has been my pleasure, Sherman. This was an uplifting conversation for me. It was a blessing to me, and I hope it was encouraging for your audience as well.
Thank you. Thank you so much. Oh, also, where can people find you?
On Instagram, we're veritas.alaska. They can go to our website, veritasalaska.com. And like I said, we work with people all over the US, but Alaska's got some cachet to it, some mystery to it. So we kept it in the website. So veritasalaska.com. And just, yeah, let us know what we can do to help.
Thank you. Thank you so much. All right, Chad, thank you again, and have a great rest of your day.
Thank you.
We hope you're leaving this episode feeling empowered. Remember, greatness is a choice. To stay updated on our latest content and continue sharpening your edge, hit that subscribe button. Let's keep grinding together. Remember to visit militantgrind.com.